So I have a question. Are you guys music students, or are you like in one of the real schools? Which? Are you guys music or MDiv or anything? What are y'all? Both? See, that's not gifted. That's confusion if you're preaching and singing. I want you to open your Bibles to Mark 14. I remember the very first time I ever got the call to preach in chapel. I'm sitting in my office. Dr. Hemphill was the president at the time. And so my secretary buzzes me and says, look, there's a Dr. Hemphill, the president of Southwestern Seminary. He's on the phone for you. Now that can make you feel really good or make you really scared because you're thinking, you know, maybe they want me to do something, or I missed a course that they didn't realize and my diploma isn't valid, so I'm going to have to come back. So I'm walking through this thing, and then finally Dr. Hemphill gets on the phone. He says, Chris, we want you to come preach in chapel. Now, at this point, all the trepidation is gone, and now you're arrogant. Now you're looking in the mirror going, well, I should have recognized how great a speaker I am by now, and obviously I'm gifted, and they finally realize this, and I got it. And then Dr. Hemphill said, the guy you're replacing. So now you're back down, but you're still kind of hoping maybe there's some spiritual quality to you that's why they're calling you. And then I promise you, this is what he said. Then Dr. Hemphill said, and we don't have to fly you up here. You can drive. So now I realize I'm just a cheap date. Since Dr. Patterson has never offered to fly me, then I'm assuming the reason I'm still here, I'm still a cheap date. So there we go. Mark 14, verse 3. Probably one of the most insightful, pragmatic, utilitarian messages for those of us in ministry in the entire Word of God. Listen to what happens. Talking about Jesus, he's in Bethany in the house of Simon the leper. He's reclining at a table when a woman came to him with an alabaster vial of genuine nard, extremely valuable. She broke it. She broke that vial and she poured it on his head. And there were some there indignant among themselves. Why has this perfume been wasted? This could have been sold for 300 denarii, could have been a year's wages, and given to the poor, and they castigated her. And Jesus said, leave her alone. Why do you bother her? She's done a good work for me. You always have the poor with you, and whenever you want to, you can do something good for them, but you do not always have me. She's done what she could. And then the two telling statements. She's anointed my body beforehand for burial. Telling you the truth, whenever the gospel is preached in the entire world, what she has done shall be spoken in her memory. Now, we have to do a little pre-work here. When you walk through a narrative, I'm doing this because my major professor is down here and he'll correct me when this is over, but when you walk through a narrative, there are certain things you have to look at. One of them, for example, is how is the conflict in the narrative resolved? It's uniquely resolved in this when it's not resolved by an act. There's obviously this conflict by these whiny people, probably a precursor to deacons. You have these whiny people who are here griping. Judas, we know, is probably instigating this. And so they're griping about it, and so there's this conflict. They're sort of really the aside. Jesus solves the conflict. He resolves it not by an act but by a statement. It's an amazing statement. He said, what she has done, everywhere the gospel goes, this story is going with the gospel. Now, he doesn't say that about anything else, not even the resurrection of her own brother, not Jairus' daughter being raised. There's no other story, this one. So obviously, this story is pivotal for those of us that are taking the gospel out and all of its implications. This story goes with it for some particular reason. So Jesus solves the conflict by a statement. Now, one other thing you look at in narratives are the characters, the people. Now, we know with Jesus Christ, obviously, several things, but one thing we're absolutely sure about him, he doesn't just run off at the mouth. When he says something, It's always with the utmost precision. He's very sure, he's very key. He doesn't say this and really mean this. When he says something, it is precise. Now, the second one we know is Mary. This is Lazarus and Martha's sister. We know a couple things about her. We know she has just recently seen her brother die, buried, resurrected. So she understands that dynamic. The other thing we know about her, she's extremely spiritually sensitive. She doesn't know she lives in an oral society, but she understands the makeup of that. Because when Jesus comes to Mary and Martha's house one day and begins to speak, she leaves Martha, she gets into the room, she sits down, and she is absolutely focused on what he says because she knows nobody's recording this, nobody's writing this down. If she misses it, she misses it. Which brings Martha, of course, into play, one of our favorite characters in the New Testament, a pure melancholy woman who is one of the people that, and there's some of you in this room like this, that you fold your towels a certain way because you say they can't fit in the cabinet unless they're that way, which is a complete lie. It's the same cubic feet, but there are some of you in here that say that, and that would be Martha. My favorite part in the story is when she comes, she doesn't even bust Mary, she busts Jesus. She walks in and she says, Lord, do you not care about all the things I'm doing? Mary has left me. She should be in here folding the towels with me. Jesus says, Mary has chosen the good part which will not be taken from her. So we know Mary's gone through this intense death, burial, and resurrection of her brother recently. She's spiritually sharp. And then the detail in the narrative, which is she brings in this crazy little thing of perfume which doesn't have a spray top or a screw-off cap. You have to break it, and you get to use it once. So you're using it either on a particular person or a particular occasion or something of a combination. And it's worth a year's salary. So here's what we know. We've got Jesus who is incredibly precise. Doesn't run off the mouth. He says something. It's absolutely with clarity. We have Mary who understands what he says. She's spiritually sensitive. She's been through the recent death, burial, and resurrection of her own brother. So she comes into the room with this incredibly expensive year salary perfume. She breaks it. She walks up to Jesus, and she begins to put it on his head and in a holy way, massage him and touch him and caress him. To which the reaction is horrible, and then Jesus makes the statement, get off her back. This is going always where the gospel goes for this reason. Here's what he says. Look in verse 8. She's done what she could. She has pre-anointed my body for burial. Now that makes no sense. The burial. She pre-anointed it for the death. Okay. He spends 6 hours in utter agony, suffering emotionally, physically, and spiritually. So if she'd anointed him for the death, that makes absolute sense. But she doesn't. She doesn't anoint him for the resurrection. She anoints him for the burial. Let me explain something. The burial is the best time Jesus Christ has had in 33 years. He's home. He told the thief on the cross, today you will be with me in paradise. He's home. He doesn't have this restrictive flesh on anymore. He's home where people idolize him, worship him, revere him, praise him. Nobody's cursing him. Nobody's challenging him. Nobody's mocking him. Nobody does anything but worship his person and holiness. So the burial, that's the best time for him. But it's the worst time for her. He's gone. She can't talk to him. She can't pour anything on him. She can't feel him. She can't hear him. She can't speak to him, which she knew happened with her own brother. So she knows what the burial means. It's not the hard time for him. it's the hard time for her. So what she says is, when she breaks the most expensive thing maybe she has in the house, that she can only use one time, and she comes in, and as he's reclining, she pours this on his head and massages it down him. And he says, I'll tell you why she's doing it. She's doing it because she understands my burial. It's the best time for me, the worst time for her. What she was saying was, when life's at the worst, I can't see you, I can't hear you, I can't speak to you, you don't speak back to me. And when you've made a promise that I don't see any other way for you to live it out, and that is your own resurrection, you say, well, wait a minute, she saw Lazarus resurrected, yeah, but Jesus resurrected Lazarus. She's looking around at the disciples. I don't think she looks at anybody that can pull him out. Now, knowing Peter, he'd probably take a shot. But I think she's looking at this group of men going, there's nobody that can pull Jesus out. So even though he said he was coming out of the grave, I don't see how in the world he can honor that. So when I'm at my worst, I can't hear him, I can't feel him, I can't sense him. He's at his best, I'm at my worst, and there's a promise I'm not sure he can live out. I'm not quitting, I'm not backing up. I, at that very moment, will give him my best. That is why this story goes with the gospel. When you take this thing out, now let's just be real honest here. We got time, right? I'm in control here. I'm done when this is over, but right now is really an easy time for you. I know you think it's not. You've got all these deadlines and all this stuff. Let me tell you something. When you take this message of the gospel out into people's lives in ministry, it is the most devastatingly difficult thing you will ever do. I know this is cliche to say that we have the highest calling, but cliche or not, it's true. And what we have in the highest calling is we will have the most passionate attack and we will have the most difficult life of anybody. We have missed the understanding of the metaphor of shepherd in the New Testament. We don't get it. We have romanticized it. We turn it into a little kid in a bathrobe and a stick in the Easter pageant. Let me explain how this really works. My son's here, and he was one of the shepherds one year in our Easter pageant at Central. Now, back then, we were doing it in the Civic Center, which is a government building, so we didn't care about using live animals. If they tore that up, we didn't care. We don't do that in our church anymore because we care far more about our church than we do government buildings. But at that point, we're in there, so we got live animals. So my son's got a live sheep. He's sitting there, and he's kneeling because this lady's singing this passionate song about Christ in our pageant. And he said, Dad, all of a sudden, I feel the sheep relieving itself on me. And he said, I can't stop the sheep, and I can't stop the song. So I have to just kind of sit there and treasure the moment. That is shepherding. If you're a shepherd in the first century, right, they don't have the clothing we have. If you're outside and it's hot, you're hot. If it's raining, you're wet. If it's cold, you're cold. If it's dry, you're thirsty. Now, you got a bunch of sheep you've got to fool with, and maybe most of them are pretty compliant, but you're going to have one or two that are just knuckleheads. They're going to go over here. You got to find them, pull them back, get them with the rest of the sheep. They're hard to deal with. Then you have the ones that are really stupid. They're running all over the place. You got to fight them all the time. You finally get them down. You get everything settled. You finally get everything right. And then you look around, and there are wolves and bears and lions from the outside trying to get in the inside. And so it is absolutely, the metaphor of shepherd was not this sweet little thing we have in our pageants. It was the most difficult job in the first century other than slavery. So when the Bible paints us as shepherds, it's to warn us, don't romanticize that. When you go out of here and you stand in a church and you take that gospel and you move it out into people's lives, listen, it is the highest calling, so you're going to have the highest of lows. But let me assure you, the highest of highs, and you're going to have the lowest of lows. It is passionately difficult. Now, you're going to deal sometimes with goofy, just funny people. When I, a buddy of mine, when I was in seminary, my last semester, back before any of you were born, but back then, I was in my last semester, and a buddy of mine said, I want you to preach at my church in Centerville, Texas. So I go to Centerville, and I preach for him when it's over. Now, this is exactly what happened. When it's over, these two guys walk up to me, and they go, Brother Osmond, we want you to come preach next week at Memorial Baptist in Oakwood, Texas. I'm in. Service starts at 10:55. I'm good. So I get there. My wife's with me. One of the kids at that time, she's sitting down here, a small little sanctuary. I get on the stage, and I'm sitting there, and this guy that has asked me to do that stands up, and he says, Brother Osborne is here today in view of a call. And I'm not about to look at my wife, because if she starts laughing, I'm done. So I'm hearing this, and I'm like, did he just say, I'm in view of a call? So sure enough, I finished Sunday night service. They call me as their pastor. They don't know what I believe about Jesus. They don't know what I believe about the Bible. The only thing, they just want a cheap date. So I wind up going there, and about 2 months after we're there, we're driving home one night back to seminary, and this trooper pulls me over, and he's writing me a ticket for speeding. So he gets done, and he finishes it up, and he's just about to finish the signing, and he looks at me, and he goes, so you got a Fort Worth address. What are you doing down here? I said, well, I'm pastor in Oakwood. He said, Memorial Baptist? I said, yes, sir. And he went, shoot, son, you need the money, and tore the ticket up. So sometimes it's just goofy, funny. Sometimes it's goofy, crazy. I'm at my second church, and there's about 9 or 10 of us on a Wednesday night, and we're having Bible study, right? So this guy looks up, and he says, this is what he said in the room. Brother Chris, this week my refrigerator went out, and I laid my hands on it and healed it. Now, of course, when they say that, what happened? Everybody's looking at you. Now, I don't care what grade you made in systematic, you don't have an answer for that. Can God heal a refrigerator? Yeah. Can he use his hands to heal the refrigerator? Yeah. Did he do it? No. But can you say that? No. You can't call him a liar in front of everybody. So you just sit and do this. Okay. Because you have no answer. And then I pastored this second church for 2.5 years. So and sometimes it's just goofy mean. I leave the church, and I go to my third church in Midland. So we send back for my letter. We get this letter back from the deacons and the church secretary, who gave me fits all the time I was there, and said, we don't have your letter. So I go to my first church, and they had my letter. Apparently, the secretary, who didn't like me, didn't like the way I joined, so she just didn't send for my letter. So for 2.5 years, I'm the only person in the history of Southern Baptist Convention that pastored a church, and I was never a member. And I'm actually, knowing that on my resume, actually quite grateful for that. Now, but then you run into these people that are just wonderful. I mean, they just really do enrich your life. When I went to Bryan, there was a 70-year-old deacon when I went there, just great man of God, buried him 25 years later. He's one of those guys that was just in your corner. He loved you. People might pop me, but buddy, he was in my corner, stood for me. Even if he disagreed with where I was leading, he was always there for me. And so that guy, those kind of guys are rich. And there's just something about them being in your life that makes the ministry just fun. But then sometimes it turns it into one of the most difficult moments in your life. I had a guy in Midland that I just adored. It's one of those guys got there, we just hit it off. We ate every Friday afternoon at a country club there and just had a great, great time, Bill Hyde. I still have his photo, as a matter of fact, on my wall. So we spent a couple of years just treasuring each other. To make a long story short, he goes in the hospital. Eventually, he winds up dying. So the night that he dies, I go up to the hospital. I walk into the room because I'm extremely close to the family. It's obvious he's on the way out. He's still cognizant, but he can't speak anymore. He's been trying to write, but he can't even do that anymore. But he can make contact with you with his eyes, and so you can tell he still knows where he is, but he knows the end is coming. And so I walk in, the family's there, and so we're chit-chatting, and I'm looking, and Bill's looking at me, and he won't let go of me, and he's very agitated. Man, it's hard for me to tell a story, but so I just think he wants me to leave the room, wants to just die with his family. So I get ready to leave, and one of the daughters said, no, I think he wants you to sit on the bed with him. Sit on the bed, and he puts his arm around me. Stop the agitation. So I drive home, man, about 1:30 in the morning. I've got to stop and pull over and just weep for 20 minutes because here's one of the richest guys in my life, but I just lost him. Yes. That is excruciatingly painful. Yes. Then you have the people that come to you for wisdom you don't have. I had a young couple. I did their premarital, did their wedding, worked with them, did their one-year anniversary. We walked through all sorts of stuff, and they had trouble getting pregnant. And so they did the in vitro, did all the stuff, spent a lot of money, finally called me and said, man, Brother Chris, we're pregnant. I'm so excited. And then about 4 months into the pregnancy, called me back and said, they discovered a genetic abnormality in our child, and they say that our child's going to die at birth. And so, sure enough, birth comes. Mom holds Caden for 1 minute, Dad holds him for 2 minutes, and Caden's gone. So when they come to you and they say, why? And they're looking at you, the one who represents Jesus Christ in their life. And you don't really have an answer for that. And I'm going to tell you, it's exhausting. And it's hard. Now, there are moments that are really good. You have those Sundays where you preach and you just feel like God's in the room and it worked. And even if nobody comes forward, you just, boy, he was there. Then you have the next Sunday when you're in the middle of the sermon going, man, I'm bored. I don't know what they're thinking. And then you have those Mondays where, you know, everything's worked well. Sunday was great. A lot of people join. Everybody's pumped about the church. And then you have that person come up to you and say, Brother Chris, I found a preacher just like you. I mean, they're so immersed in the Word. They've touched my heart so much. I just finished a book by Joel Osteen, and I'm so excited about who he is in my life. So I'm telling you, it can look glamorous, but it's not. The ministry where you take the gospel into people's lives is the hardest thing you'll ever do. There is no higher calling. There is no more difficult calling. So there are going to be times when you want to pack. Now, there are two ways you can quit. You can absolutely leave the ministry, or you can just emotionally quit and pack it out. You can do that. You can hide the ministry for a long while. A lot of people do that. Or on those days when you're really just tired, you read this, you don't seem to get anything out of it. You pray. You don't feel like you're reaching past the ceiling. You don't hear his voice. You don't sense his presence. You've got these promises that it just really doesn't look like can be enacted in your life. That's a point at which you can quit, or you can do what she did. Do the best you can at the worst moment in your life. You can get up and say, you know what, God, tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to do my best study this week. I'm going to counsel my best. I'm going to be the best guy at the hospital. I'm going to be the best pastor I can for this church, regardless of what I feel. And you don't do that because you're tough and you're courageous and you're strong. That's football. That's not Christianity. You don't do it because you're great and you're courageous and you're strong. You do it for the same reason Mary did it. She did it because he was great, he was courageous, he was strong.